Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Josh Brown, what happened to Robbie Williams? Yeah, he sort of changed his entire look and he had, like, he put an eye on his hand and all that.
I love it, man. Like, yeah. I watched the Robbie Williams documentary on Netflix a few months ago. That's what I was doing while I was off. And you know what?
It took you 4 months.
Not a great documentary, but a genuinely good portrayal of a man in show business, a high profile guy, having a mental breakdown. Telling people he's having a mental breakdown and everyone going,
nah,
get on stage, you'll be all right. No, it's just Rob having a laugh. Yeah, genuinely just, quite good through that lens. Otherwise, a crap documentary that just takes things for granted, but a cool little bit of insight.
I've never dove onto the reality of what Mr. Williams was going through, but at the time, I imagine, like you said, the people behind the cameras just being, just make it part of your act, Rob.
There is a great bit in it, right, where he's doing, I can't remember what album cycle it is, but he's doing an interview with this guy to promote it. And the guy's saying, are you looking forward to this show? I think he might have been doing like Nebworth or something, a huge show. And he just kind of gets really honest and he's like, nah, to be honest with you, I'm absolutely bricking it. Like, I'm anxious, I'm terrified, I'm not sleeping, I'm not looking after myself. I'm really, really worried about it. And then the guy goes, oh, come on, Rob, give us a nice one. And he goes, what? And he goes, should I do it again? But like, be upbeat. And he's like, if you don't mind.
Oh, my God.
So then he cut into a second take and he's like, oh, yeah, the show. I can't wait for it. Yeah, I can't wait. It's amazing. You're all a bit worried about it, but can't wait for it. I'm like, the fact that you have that on camera is amazing.
I was going to say, I feel like that is so emblematic and it crystallizes the old school approach to mental health, dealing with
literally,
mental health.
Right? Yeah.
Like, have you tried not being like that? Have you tried just saying the opposite and just pretending that's reality instead? That's hilarious. I might have to check it out for the sake of
man, that and the Beckham documentary, which released last year. Two surprisingly good British-focused, mostly, Netflix documentaries.
I do wonder if our American listenership or the worldwide global listenership want to know who Robbie Williams is. Please get in touch if you're from a country that isn't the UK and you know who Robbie Williams is. If you're curious about what your thoughts on his trajectory are.
Well, here's the thing. Funnily enough, alongside, you know, Robbie's mental breakdown last year while I was having my own. I also watched twice, and this is an indicative of what place I was in there, an old Busted documentary from MTV, which is called like America or Busted. It's about them trying to break into America, obviously, trying to get, you know, recognition over there. And they go into a meeting with this music executive and he jokes about Robbie Williams being the biggest thing in the UK and how he, his quote was, and I remember this because I watched it twice, how they flew Robbie in to America on business class and they sent him back in like the cheap seats because nobody wanted Robbie in America.
No way.
So I don't know if this will translate at all for our American listeners, but the Beckham documentary at least will. Mm. He was a big deal in America.
I'm old enough to remember the whole idea of like British entertainers not being able to make it in America. It was a big deal when someone like Ricky Gervais went over there and actually got audiences.
Right.
And, he wasn't the first comedian to ever get an audience in America that was from a different country, but that used to be a thing that you couldn't even what culture's video history, like when we started making videos is before you were hired back in like 2013, 2014, the idea being that you couldn't use an accent, that you couldn't have anything regards to an accent. And when I was lucky enough to meet Ralph Ineson, who's from Game of Thrones and he's played Sid in Final Fantasy 16. I met him at the Golden Joysticks last year, and we were talking about how over the years, like, accents have become okay.
Yeah.
And he said Game of Thrones is what changed all of it. Because, I mean, Sean Bean was always pretty thick in his accent anyway.
Man, yeah.
But now there's more of a demand for it. And, like, we felt quite seen when Cid is, like, a broad Geordie in Final Fantasy 16. And it is interesting, that idea of, or that assumption that America just doesn't want it, wants, like, a specific version of English, Queen's English kind of thing.
I think even the UK doesn't want it to a certain extent. Like, I was even flattening my accent when I first started working here for UK listeners, because they would rip the piss out of me for saying film. And it's like, it's something I never thought about before, because when I grew up, everyone around me said, pronounced film. Film.
Oh, like film.
Like film.
Right, okay.
And I just never thought about it. And then suddenly you got all these comments being like, wait, you can't even say that right. So I tried to flatten it out a bit.
But all now, these film elitists.
In the modern era, I'm trying to steer into the accent as much as possible, because it's like, This is me. We're a company based in the Northeast. Uh-huh. I grew up in the working class Northeast. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just my accent.
Yeah.
I don't need to change it around.
So I think, as long as you're comprehensible, there's a way to do both.
Like, well, that's the argument, is it? I don't think I am comprehensible sometimes, which I do need to work on. But yeah, you've got to be in balance.
I do like the idea of someone being incredibly incomprehensible and having a translator, but yeah. just per review. Just like, what he really said was he hated this level and he's not going to play any more of
Literally,
it.
Literally, I love it on the telly. When, you know, they've got a member of the public on the news or something, and they're a Geordie, and they've got subtitles. or someone who's Scottish, and they put subtitles, and I'm like, you wouldn't do that if it was someone from, like, London or speaking the Queen's English.
It depends. I think it depends on what the average assumption of, like, the comprehension of the language is.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I sold my first car to a very broad-speaking Scottish guy, and my dad had to be the translator, because he used to work in Scotland. And he was like between the two of us. I was quite young. I didn't have any Scottish friends back then. And I couldn't understand the guy at all. He was very, very broad. And that was, like, really cool. It was really fascinating. Like, I love language, but
I remember when, and I've talked about it on pretty much every podcast so far. I don't know why Ash Millman keeps coming up so much, but I remember when she was working here, and I literally, right, this is no shade on Ash, it was me, one, having this accent, and two, being a mumbler anyway while I'm usually talking to people normally, not on a podcast. But I'm pretty sure if the first 6 months I knew her, I had to repeat everything I said to her. I was like, what? And I was like, oh God, is my accent that bad? I'm that much of a mumbler. She's always like, sorry, could you say that again?
Oh, I think that's like that cat that just goes, huh, like, in every conversation. And we should say this is the wind-up, where we talk about the latest video game stories, whatever's going on in the industry, and whatever else is on our minds, to be honest. It's a whole new week.
Scott, you know what I love about the wind-up?
Go on.
Is that we can have the most structured itinerary possible going into an episode.
I've got notes and everything.
And then we somehow talk about Robbie Williams and accents for the first 5 minutes of the show.
It just had to be done.
We've got to get copyright struck for that.
That's a perfect rendition. Yeah, we're going to open on some games that we're playing, then dive into some video game news, which is to say that I finished Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I'm not going to go on about it too much because I've mentioned it a lot across the last week. I'm waiting for Sai to finish because she's almost at the end, and then me and her will do some sort of spoiler chat, some sort of what the living hell is this game style conversation. I did go back to it post-finishing, and I do want to say that I think that game's biggest... the best way to enjoy Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is to not care about the main story, is to not care about the comparisons to the original, is just to try and enjoy this series of Final Fantasy VII themed things. Here's some minigames, here's some beautiful vistas, here's some level designs. Combat's always immaculate. Combat and character writing was always immaculate. But it is the design of some of the side quests, it is the design of some of the main quests that is just so bloated. And then they whiff all the main story beats. Like, I could do essays on how much they get wrong. But I think one of my biggest journeys with this game has just been of acceptance, which was the same thing with Remake. And it is just accepting that it is a worse version of all those core tenets, all those core thematics, all those core plot beats. But it's not to say that it's not an enjoyable collection of game mechanics anyway. And when you're freed of trying to chase the main story and wondering what they've done with the plot spoilers and whatever else, and you can kind of just mop stuff up like as and when you want, it clicks in a way that is just better. But it's weird that you have to almost fundamentally divorce yourself of pacing for that to happen. However, I get the argument that you could say that about various other huge RPGs like Dragon Quest XI or Infinite Wealth, like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, even though I would argue Infinite Wealth has way better character pacing and it gives you more excuses to diverge from the the main thread. Seven is a whole roller coaster mess, but I continue to analyze it, and thankfully I'm not reviewing it, so I don't need to have a definitive state.
I think again, I've not played Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, so I'm not going to comment necessarily on that specifically. This is what I'm talking about being incomprehensible. But you mentioned something really interesting there, and that's, you know, pacing in general. And you mentioned, you know, obviously other open world games suffer from that same issue or don't really prioritize pacing. And I definitely have felt that across the board. Mm. With the shift to open world games over the past, you know, 10 years or so, probably even longer, and the shift towards larger experiences, I do think the kind of the art of pacing a story has gone by the wayside. And that's as someone who defends these longer games. But I think of the amount of times I've hit the last act of a story and it's thrown me a bunch of missions that I wasn't expecting, more side content, more things to check off the box. And I've just thought, I wish you weren't here.
Yeah.
It feels like we're barreling towards the end and suddenly I've got a lot of other stuff to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I of course know it's optional. I don't have to do that. But if, say, I've completed every side quest until then and the, you know, the checklist is telling me I'm 80% through the main story and it feels like there's nothing else to come and suddenly there's a bunch of stuff, I'll feel compelled to finish everything because, I mean, I've taken a completionist approach so far. And I think, yeah, games generally just kind of need to get that focus back, I think.
Yeah, man.
Even though I am someone who will do everything in an open world game and that doesn't bother me as much as I think it maybe bothers you.
You're going to hate that in Rebirth. Rebirth is ostensibly five open world games that all repeat. And you're doing like a little mini open world and then a story chunk. And then here's another little mini open world with the same overall design. Like go get some more towers, go here and hold a button kind of thing. Interspersed with like some side quest stuff that has good character writing in it and good payoffs. But the mechanics of what you're actually doing in those quests are horrific. It's just such a mixed bag. But now that I've finished it and I'm kind of just sitting back and thinking about it. And I'm just like, it's all over the place. Like I didn't enjoy my majority of time with it. The positives were very high, but I think it gets in its own way constantly.
Yeah.
But yeah, that whole thing about like there being an art to the open world drive is such a thing that I remember realizing with The Witcher 3. Because I was like, this is great. You're just this supernatural bounty hunter. You need to be chasing, finding out what's going on with Ciri. But you can kind of take your time with it and and it would make sense that Geralt would take on all these side quests. The way Rebirth is set up, to me, it doesn't make any sense that you'd be doing anything other than chasing down what the hell's been going on at the end of Remake.
Right.
And so it kind of gets in its own way. And then the more that they add all this laborious, bloated, you know, pace killing stuff, it's weird to then sit and indulge in that when you haven't even had a main slice of the main narrative to justify what are you even goofing off from?
See,
like,
yeah.
It's just a weird vibe. And I think that like, it's always case by case, but if I compare it to Infinite Wealth or games that are just open-ended from the jump, like Dragon Quest XI or something, stuff like, I don't know, there's a weird thing where sometimes it just feels off and it's like you kind of need to do enough of the main thing to be like, oh, okay, I know what the overall narrative framing is, so it makes sense that our characters would then go and do this, as opposed to I'm just going to goof off for 50 hours and then do a main thing later.
I think that's definitely where we have a bit of a split, because I don't mind that anywhere near as much as you, I don't think. I remember when we were talking about, don't even think it was on a podcast, just in the office, we were talking about Baldur's Gate 3 and Act 3 and how when you arrive at Baldur's Gate, you know, I was very happy to just sort of hang around the circus, do side missions, and I know you were,
I hated the circus,
wanted it to be more propulsive, whereas, you know, I was just like, well, this is the game to me. This is what kind of what I'm here for. I like the main quests in games, of course I do, but I'm fine almost suspending my disbelief enough to kind of just come up with excuses to do everything else
right. But
the main story. But I do agree that, you know, you described, again, don't know if it was on the podcast or off the podcast,
They're the same thing these days.
Everything is the same. but you mentioned that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth was to you what Days Gone was to me a few years ago, where it was a game with a lot of highs, but at a certain point, it just felt too long. It felt too bloated. It felt like you wanted it to be over. And I always hate getting in that mode with a game where you might have been even loving it, but you just get to a point where you think, oh, why isn't this finishing? Why isn't this coming to an end? Did it need to be this long? Did we need to get another map or another set of missions? What do they actually add to the experience?
Totally.
If anything, I think it gets to a point where that bloat and that length actually detracts from the first 50 hours you might have put into a game, and suddenly you're spending the last 20 thinking, oh, this has left me with a bit of a sour taste in the mouth.
Yeah, and I think it's like three-act structures exist for a reason, and I don't think you need to doggedly stick to them. But I think if you're setting things up that feel like you're rounding the bend of the end of the second act going into the third one, which is my Baldur's Gate 3 thing, where finally at Baldur's Gate, things are happening in regards to the main story threads, I do think it's then harder to pull off. This is why you then go 50, do 50 hours or something else. And I do think to add to the whole, there's a depth, there's an art to this, that there's a beauty in a really well-structured endgame. Like, yeah. I think that, like, you'll see, you'll try and do everything and then finish on a high and hit the credits and I'm done. As opposed to, I almost treat it mentality-wise like single player, multiplayer on like Call of Duty. I'll do the campaign, get it out of the way, and then I'll indulge in the multiplayer. In terms of certain open world stuff, it's like, I'll do the main campaign, see what that is. Maybe I'll make a dummy save to go back to. But if the game is structured in a certain way, like God of War Ragnarok, then you give me propulsion to go do everything else in my own time, at my own leisure. And I'm not worried about being spoiled online or chasing down the main narrative or whatever. And in Final Fantasy's case, I already made a bunch of saves anyway, so I just reloaded one of those and I was like, this is going to be my trophy mop-up save. But I know I'm not up against trying to chase answers in the main campaign, and it works better like that. It works better the less you care, because it's just right, like, okay, the overall design. If you're trying to hurry it along, it won't. And if you're trying to get some satisfying answers in the next few hours, it won't. They'll be 10, 20, 30 hours down the line. It's a giant behemoth of a thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's fascinating. Like, I think it's incredible that you have the original team from the 90s, like, you know, Tetsuya Nomura and everybody else, taking, like, you know, okay, we're going to flesh this out and flesh this out and flesh this out with the backing of Square Enix. And it's like, it's just dripping in opulence. It's so much money and so many ideas. But then it just is this big, unwieldy, mutated thing that is like a weird corporate side of it and the creative side of it and the gameplay side of it. And I don't know. It's like Genova, like Genova in Final Fantasy, that big mutated alien from like that you see in the remake. Unless you forgot,
I've forgotten that
you fight. It's at the end. You fight a big crazy alien. The rest of us did. Before you fight Sephiroth, you fight like a big mutated alien thing inside Shroom headquarters.
Yeah, I must have blocked that out from
great
my
great stuff. Mind. Anyway,
yeah, great.
That thing's called Genova, and that's what Final Fantasy has become. Genova. It gives life. It sets everything else in motion, but it's a big mutated, horrible looking thing.
It's funny, man. You mentioned that thing about having, you know, a previous save to go back through, and this is very much a personal hang up that I have. It's a very strange thing that I get caught up in. But you know, you mentioned before how when the MCU started to introduce the concept of the multiverse, that kind of flattened the stakes for you and made some things a little bit meaningless.
It killed the whole thing for me.
On a much lesser scale, I almost treat, right, when I've completed a story and kind of completed a game, I treat those older saves as kind of like a multiversal branch, and it makes me like them less. I don't have the purpose.
I know exactly what you mean.
And I know that's very strange because it's a game, and at that point you're just like mopping up side quests, seeing what you missed. Of course, that's fine, but I treat that master save as like gospel.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's the main timeline.
That's the main timeline, and I almost feel like, well, if I didn't do this in the main timeline, what does it all mean? And it's a strange thing considering how just weird and meta system is.
I think of that stuff too, and I'm always, if at the end of you start discovering side quest stuff that is actually weirdly would have meant something in the main thing, but you haven't done the main thing yet because it's an older save. It's like, oh my god, I should have done this and then done the main thing, but I can't do that now because whatever. It's Final Fantasy VII, the reboot, just to round everything out, I'm fascinated by the entire craft of it. It has a soul, it has charm. It needed to exist on behalf of the people who put it together. It doesn't feel studio mandated at all, although it does have sensibility to it that has to justify itself in the eyes of Square Enix, because 2020's bailed them out after the Avengers bombed so hard.
Yeah.
And it's, I think there's a whole conversation there about how many different boxes they had to tick in regards to an open world game to try and make sure it would sell even better. And then you look at the sales that are like so far disastrous. And I want way more clarity on that, but everything seems to be pointing to a game that is bombing. And that's why they're not talking about it and why it's not trending on the PlayStation Store, and how the physical sales were less than half of Remake. And so I'm fascinated by it. You've been playing Cannibal Abduction, though.
Yes, and this is mostly because I'm playing two other games that I can't talk about on this podcast, but I will be able to talk about in their entirety on next week's wind-up, and there may even be a review for one of them dropping this week, who knows? Yeah, keep an eye on the channel, you know what I mean? But in between all of that, I've been playing Cannibal Abduction, which is a game published by Puppet Combo. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's developed.
We should refer to them as Josh Brown's Puppet Combo.
I wish, man. I don't deserve old that GB title. They're much cooler than me, much cooler games. But this is from the same publisher that gave me specifically Stay Out of the House last year, which I absolutely adored. Mm-hmm. And this is a new release on console. I know it's been out a while on PC, but it was a fiver on the PlayStation Store. Mm-hmm. It's only about an hour and a half long, but it was just a hit of something that I needed. It's a third person, like, light survival horror game. Like, okay. I said, not very long. You're this guy, you are trapped in this house with a cannibal. You're abducted, you might say, and you pretty much just have to get out. And okay. It's just solving a few puzzles. There's no combat. You're hiding from this guy as he chases you. But I just love the presentation of these games. It, like Stay Out of the House, it has a PlayStation 1 throwback aesthetic. It doesn't rely too heavily on the CRT filter, though there is a certain level of VHS grain there. And I when I'm playing it, I just think, why don't all games look like this? Why has it endured, because we're getting games like this quite regularly now, but
shout out to Signalis.
There's something about it, and I think it's more than nostalgia, where I play one of these games and it's blocky and it's gray and it's brown and there's very little in the way of music, and the horror is kind of just accentuated by the footsteps of your character, which sound like the footsteps from a PlayStation 2 game or a PlayStation 1 game, in that they're kind of exaggerated and don't really sound like footsteps.
Right,
that
okay.
sounds like, you know, two bits of brick sort of slamming against each other.
Like, some guy was like, we need the Foley artist. We need some footsteps. So could you walk? Nah, I'm going to bash these bricks today. Yeah, I'm not going to record my feet. Not crazy.
And it uses tank controls, and it has a few good scares in there, but it's just another one of those, you know, we were talking there about the length of modern games. To get something that is £5 and is an hour and a half, but really satisfies a Friday night itch where you've got, you know, the lovely mood lighting on, you've just had a lovely tea, you've got some snacks, and you just kind of want to play something that's kind of low stakes, I would say. You're not going to be engaging with a lot of systems. Mm. You're not having to take in a big story lore dump or anything like that. You're just kind of jumping in for an hour and a half, and it was exactly what I needed. And in an amazing way, it comes bundled with what is essentially a B-side, which is, I think it's called Scissor Man on the menu, but I think it's called The Night of the Scissor Man or something.
That's
like that.
Cool.
The Night of the Scissors, which is a short, even shorter experience than that. It's like 25 minutes, half an hour. And it's a similar concept. You have this burglar who finds themselves in this kind of like office building, and that you're trapped in with this dude called the Scissor Man.
Great.
Who has been chopping up his victims with scissors. And the
gimmick, like a giant pair of scissors?
No, just a small pair.
I was going to say, is it the dude from Clock Tower?
Yeah, it's actually, right. No, I thought when I was playing it, it was going to be like big shears, but they're small scissors, which somehow makes it scarier.
How much damage can they really do?
Well, a lot, apparently, because you can tell when he's around, because you hear the snip snip of his scissors.
Oh,
like,
that's
it's
cool.
Like snip, 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 and it gets louder the closer he is.
That's when you get a haircut and they get a little bit too close to the ear, and it's like, oh.
Oh, you're going to chop it off.
Yeah.
Don't stick that in there.
I'm not Van Gogh.
No, absolutely not. And just like the sound design of these games is great, and they're funny. There's one line that popped me silly in the Scissor Man one, where it's not spoken, it's just text, but you're breaking into this place, and the guy goes, I need you to keep a lookout for people, comma, specifically cops, while I break into this thing. It's something about comma, specifically cops. Like, who else are you looking out for? I just thought that was so funny.
Specifically cops is the overlooked indie band of the summer.
Yeah. I just found that so funny. It's got like that playfulness to it. And I said it was published by Puppet Combo. It is, but it's a subsidiary of theirs that I'm actually forgetting. But they also published a game I played last year called No One Lives Under That Lighthouse, which is similarly a PS1 throwback. That's more of a walking simulator. It's first person, and I love that as well. So I'm just eager to see what comes next, and I'm eager to catch up on the games that I've missed, because I had a great time with these titles, and I maybe want to go back and play like Silent Hill 2 on the PlayStation 2.
I was going to say, like,
check out more things with tank controls and static cameras.
That's the thing. Me and you've talked loads about, and everyone, whenever I talk about this, people know exactly what it is, although it doesn't really have a specific name, but that late 90s PS1 horror era, where even games that weren't horror games had horror elements in them, like Metal Gear Solid. Final Fantasy VII's opening is terrifying.
Yeah.
The original one. And I feel like, yeah, like it was, and then specifically in the horror genre, you had the static cameras, the tank controls. There was something about that whole era, something about de-resed horror always worked. We've done lists on it before, like games that looked like hell, but were still terrifying, like the Atlanteans at the end of Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
The big fangs, and they were coming at you, but even because it's less textured or less rendered, your mind makes up the difference. And that's like, there's a whole quintessential horror side of that anyway, which I love all that stuff. Like I, Puppa Combo, like, feel if this is something that they've published, it feels like Puppa Combo overall are kind of like a mini Devolver, where were like 10 years ago, where like after Hotline, after they published Hotline by Denaton, like Devolver were kind of seen as this like hazy, grubby VCR filter dev publisher, sorry. And then they got bigger and bigger and bigger, but they never got that big. And they're sort of like, they have a really good charm to them. And it's like, I feel like with Puppa Combo, even though we're only a few games in, they have an identity to them. And like, you snapped it up because you know what you're getting from them.
Yeah, precisely that. There's like a certain level of trust there because there is that familiarity. Like, this shares a lot of mechanics with Stay Out of the House, which Stay Out of the House probably shares a lot of mechanics with the games that I haven't played. But I think, yeah, they've obviously been around for a good while now, but have had that PC audience there, that dedicated PC audience. But it feels like they're bringing more of their games and more of their published games to consoles now. You know, they've already had a few on there, but it seems like there's one coming every couple months, which is cool. I'm going to play one called Night at the Gates of Hell next.
That's a great.
Which I cannot
these are all just like Judas Priest albums. Like I should be on these as much as possible.
Yeah, but maybe so. And I think, yeah, like at the price point, I just can't knock it. And as a horror guy, it's just, it's shocking how much it's my thing. You know what I mean? It feels like I said it when I played Stay Out of the House. It feels like with this publisher and with the subsidiaries, I've just found like a treasure trove of stuff that's gonna appeal to me, even if they're not, you know, like 10 out of 10 experiences or anything. It's just like those little hits for the cost it's something I'm always willing to pay for stuff like this.
Yeah, I think for where I am, like on the verge of becoming a dad next month, I can't take on too much stressful stuff right now, but the Stay Out of the House is immaculate for what it is. It's such a phenomenally atmospheric experience. I love the whole structure of that game. I've only done the first couple of chapters for it, but it was so solid. Have you heard of Balatro?
You know what? Here's the thing. I'd heard nothing about this game until you messaged me.
Blowing up, Josh.
Playing it. And then I was watching a Game Maker's Toolkit video yesterday because the guy who runs that channel is making his own game and he's talking about how he's making his game, but he's playing a lot of Balatro.
Balatro is
It's a rogue. No, it's not. It's a card. What is
it? It is.
Like poker game?
Yes. It's, yeah, that's the tell thing. So someone has. I feel like every sort of few weeks there's an indie game that just sells millions out of nowhere and it's like, oh, what the hell's going on? Why do we need to pay attention to this thing? It was kind of Pacific Drive the other week in terms of the buzz. And at the minute, it's Balatro, which apparently, has sold millions of copies. There's an iPhone version coming very soon. It is literally a roguelike poker game. But you're not playing the AI in regards to, you're not playing against someone. You're just playing hands. So the way that it works is like you, I'll preface all of this by saying that I know next to nothing about poker.
Okay.
I've played lots of poker in my life. I've never felt that confident with it. I just sort of play it because I'm with the boys and we're all playing a bit of poker.
Yeah.
So I'll play a bit. But the structure of this thing is that the roguelike element is that you're building your deck, you're getting different types of jokers that have different modifiers. So, and everything is you're playing different hands based on obviously the poker hands that already exist, like straight flushes, full houses, pairs, whatever. But you're then buffing those hands based on different jokers that you get. So that's the roguelike aspect, is that you're going up against two blinds and a boss every time.
Yeah.
So it's a small blind, a large blind, and a boss. Blinds being a point total. So every hand that you play is worth a certain amount of points, but then obviously you spec that based on the different jokers that you get. You also get different card modifiers called planet cards and tarot cards that can make your deck give you more modifiers as well before you even play a hand. And so it's kind of just, it sounds overwhelming, and like as someone who doesn't really, like I said, understand poker that much or play that much of it anyway, I saw this blow up and I was like, well, I'm gonna have to play it because it's blowing up. But once I got in there, it's so good at like teaching you like the basics of poker, and then layering on all these really cool video game mechanics, and then giving you this really good, solid, addictive gameplay loop that is based around doing a run. But like that sort of underlying sense of power that you get over time of like, well, the that comes with a roguelike, you're getting more comfortable with a run. Like, oh, this feels like a good run. Mm. And then it's like you're trying to complete a run. Like, you know, if you think of a roguelike game, you're trying to get through a certain series of bosses or a certain series of levels to bank a full run, then go again. You're doing this like 8 times. Like, it's like 8 sets of 2 blinds and a boss. The bosses are always randomized. There's different modifiers as well. You can skip some of the blinds if you just want to mainline it and get to the boss. But it just works so well. It's so slickly put together. It's super easy to play. Everything's nicely tutorialized. Like, you can bring up you know, a list of the poker hands, and you get used to what goes with what, kind of thing. But some of the modifiers are just really fun. Like, yeah, you can make a deck of diamonds if you want to, and then it's like, or you can like make it so you're converting cards to different types. You're just all these different power modifiers. You know, and I had a really good run yesterday where it was like every hand, every card played counts towards a hand. So even though you can't have you know, something like an ace, two kings, whatever, that would be like a pair or something, every card plays, and mm-hmm. then everything was getting a modifier when it's played. So I was blazing through 5 tiers
right.
just off hands of 2 cards, which things like that where it's like, okay, I've specced towards clubs this time.
Yeah.
But then you might fight a boss that means that they're immune to clubs, but then you might have banked a card that means you can remove their buff. So it's like there's a whole gamified thing here.
Interesting.
It's really cool.
It sounds really fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a game that I would probably usually not look at because card games make me cry.
They make me laugh.
Poker is like the one card game I can play. I'm not very Ooh. Good at it, but it's the only one I've ever like played or right. gotten into or gambled with at a casino and lost me money because I'm not very good at it. But it's like, I actually understand the rules. I know how to play it. So
I've got my Switch. You should play it.
I was interested in this, but yeah, in my head, I'm like, well, I just want a poker game. You know what right. I mean? Like, the modifiers and stuff obviously are going to make for a more engaging game mm-hmm. and more tactical game. So I'm very intrigued about
I feel like there's been a billion poker
go.
Games.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Just, I think the aesthetic of this is really good. I briefly looked at like one of the trailers and I thought, ooh, aesthetically, it's really appealing. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned all there about the jokers, the blinds, the bosses, specking towards certain... what would you describe them? I've just said I like poker, but
it is like, well, yeah, you're sort of like making a build out of your hand.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. But how does, with it being poker, like how much, if at all, does like bluffing come into it?
Oh,
like,
it's not a thing.
Not at all.
You're basically
okay,
like
okay.
The literal gameplay is like you're dealt a hand every time, you're picking cards to play, you're choosing when to apply certain modifiers based on like, oh, I might want to raise the rank of these cards. Like, maybe I already have 2 jacks and then a 10 and a 9, and I play a modifier that turns that 10 into another jack, and then I right. play that as a 3 of a kind or whatever. And then you always have your little allocation of jokers at the top.
Yeah.
And then you can have like, you can get modifiers per run, you can change the deck type, so you maybe get increased hands, maybe you come away with more money. You're going to a store in between each run, like not an actual monetized store, but an yes. in-game store, to buy more cards. You can get vouchers that modify the run as well. But yeah, you're just trying to, it's like a boss gauntlet roguelike, but your character build is your deck. And it's like, and it's the hand that you're playing as well. But yeah, like, it's really, really cool. I think if you have enough of a passing interest in the idea of card games, it's just such a intricately designed but not overwhelming card game, and it comes across so slickly. Like, it's just so confident, and it's the fact that it's blown up because people love card games and poker games,
yes,
and everything else, and
also,
I think this is a really good step into the world of poker. You hear about poker all the time,
yeah,
like it's you know, on like random TV channels and things like that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And this is a good way of like, oh, this is how you play it. Oh, yeah. I'm confident in these hands and I need to swap this out and discard this and get more stuff. Like, it's really cool.
It's like when Mortal Kombat taught me how to play chess.
Yeah, it is.
I immediately forgot it.
Yeah, I need to see if any of these skills translate over to actual poker.
Yeah, but,
No, man, you should play some Balatro. The next thing down that we've got is you wrote down the word songs next to Cannibal Abduction.
Just very briefly, I know we've got news to get to, but I just kind of wanted to say a shout out, actually, because I know you're a musicsman, Scott Tilford. You come from down your way.
I love
and
the
you
tunes.
Can even play. You can play the guitar. Yeah. But I am someone who loves finding new licensed music in games. Mm-hmm. As you may know, I'm not much of an OST man. Like, I love and appreciate a great video game score, but I'm not someone who listens to those scores outside of the context of the game. Mm. Like, I love people who, you know, whack those things up on Spotify and can listen to them while they work, or like, put it on at home. Like, that's awesome. They're definitely worthy of that praise, but that's just not the kind of music I listen to outside of games. But a licensed score, you know, something like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
Like a collection of songs.
That brings together, like songs from the mainstream or whatever, like, and curates a collection that way. I've always been a huge, huge fan of, like, got so much of my music taste from Tony Hawk's, from Guitar Hero.
Dude, like, when EA used to specialize in it, I used to look forward, the FIFA Burnout, like, EA used to make it part of their identity, EA Tracks. It was like, you get a new EA published game, you get a new collection of songs. Like, WWE started doing that on the 2K24 thing.
Yes.
They got specific people to do it. Post Malone curated it, apparently, but they got Turnstile on there.
Exactly, man. And I mean, it goes over to movies as well. Like, a shocking amount of my formative music interests came from the American Pie soundtracks, man. Right. Like, American Pie 1 or 2, you know, Blink 182, Sum 41, all that stuff. I only ever was really into because I watched American Pie when I was little. Anyway, all of this is to say, as you may know, I've been played Pacific Drive last month, absolutely loved it. But within that game was a selection of radio stations that you can listen to while you're driving around in your car. And there's a lot of licensed music from there, a lot of, like, you know, smaller scale tunes, less mainstream tunes, because it's an indie game. But there was one song on there where I listened to it and thought, this is amazing. It's a song from a guy / band called Petey, and it had this, like, lovely little Midwestern sort of emo vibe to it. So I thought, you know, I'm gonna check out what else they've done, and I've had that their songs on repeat since I've been listening to it. It's given me a little bit of Elvis Depressedly vibes. It's given me a little bit of Foxing vibes. And it's, oh man, it was one of those where I took it from the game, took it to Spotify, and then I was immediately, like, searching PT UK tour in the browser. And there is one, but it's annoyingly sold out. So I'm going to have to keep an eye out for tickets to that. But
I wonder if that's because of Pacific Drive. People are, like, going in because of that.
Well, I was doing some research, and apparently you got big on TikTok during the pandemic, which I wasn't familiar with, but apparently that's...
I'm still yet to take TikTok.
Yeah, there you go, man.
At some point.
Apparently that helped, like it does with so many people getting their music careers off the ground and stuff, but it's so good. It hit the spot so well. And I just thought it's worth shouting out when a game can, like, you can love a game and then suddenly it has an element and you follow that thread and suddenly you found, like, one of your favorite new bands at the moment, you know?
Dude,
it's
like,
so,
I mean,
cool.
Hotline Miami was fundamental to introducing me to synthwave. I think I missed, like, the reason that doesn't happen anymore is because the license fees are so high, but, like, there was such a great era across the 2000s, early 2010s, when you would get bodies of songs alongside games themselves. Death Stranding associating itself with Low Roar so much.
Oh, yes.
Like, that was a great one.
Yeah.
Like, got into Low Roar because of them. But, like, yeah, man, whenever that can happen, it's awesome. speaking of trying to transition into the news, Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection is an abomination, an absolute ridiculously undercooked release, and I wish I was saying that for the first time. I feel like we get one of these every few weeks at this point.
How have there been so many video game open goals that have been completely skewed, Scott? Like, over the past few years, especially when it comes to remasters, obviously it still takes a lot of work to get one of those, you know, ported on new systems. It still takes graft, but surely something like bringing the Battlefront games with some modern online functionality over to PlayStation, Xbox, and Switch shouldn't be this controversial.
No.
It's the same thing with the Grand Theft Auto Definitive Edition from a few years ago. Like, that should have been another, not easy, but open
pretty
goal.
Easy compared to the new
pretty
stuff.
Pretty easy compared to, like, making something like GTA 6. You're like, the work is there, the template is there. It's something that should be able, that you should be able to get right.
Yeah, the thing is with the Star Wars re-releases as well, like the Jedi Academy re-release that was over on Xbox, like, you can play that on Xbox Live multiplayer. It's just like it used to be. It runs very smoothly. It reminded me of 2005 very nicely. It was a lovely, lovely time. Remastering the classic collection of Battlefront, and they still largely look like how you remember them. You'll have upscaled them a little bit in your head, but they haven't been completely reskinned or anything. When they had the trailer for this recently, and then it was coming out soon, I was like, this is awesome. This is exactly how you should do it. Take old school multiplayer games and have new age netcode and just sync it all up so it plays better than ever. But sadly, and it's even as at time of recording, the Battlefront Classic Collection is still on fire. There is a disparity to be called out in regards to the console performance and the PC performance. PC is by far the worst. However, one of the reasons that the game is completely beset with texture issues, performance issues, most of the levels don't even load in the correct color over on PC, and they look like patchwork quilts of all these different colors over the top stuff coming in. Overall, apparently, it's because the game launched with only three servers,
and
64 players each.
Crazy.
Did they not see it was Star Wars? Like, that it was Battlefront? There's a few things to throw in. Like, you've got the server dips all over the place. People can't even get into lobbies because there's only three servers apparently online anyway, and there are only 64 players. So even totted up, that's only 192 players.
Yes.
Which is pretty bad. There's also the side of it where Aspyr have addressed this. They said, we experienced critical errors with our network infrastructure. The result was incredibly high ping, matchmaking errors, crashes, servers not appearing in the browser. But there's a wider issue here where the game itself is 72.58 gigs big for games that are from like 2005, 2006. It's literally 10 times bigger than both original games combined. Like, what is going on over there?
I don't know, man. Because, yeah, like you said, it started, when it launched, it was like on fire. And I was hesitant to initially do a news because, like you said, they initially put out the statement. I think they even like immediately upped the server capacity. And I thought, well, you know, jobs are good, and it seems to be smooth sailing from here on out. We can kind of get over this initial launch. But then in the days since, it has just been a constant stream of complaints about the matchmaking, about the bugs you mentioned, about the glitches that shouldn't be there, about the storage. I think there's a story doing the rounds that, I don't know if this is an allegation or has been proven, so I think it's just that allegedly a modder's code was used in the final game. And it's like, why are all of these stories surrounding something like Star Wars Battlefront? You mentioned the developers, Aspyr, like, they made great ports in the past.
Like, just a couple of weeks ago.
Just a couple of weeks ago, they dropped the Tomb Raider collection, which by all accounts was a well-received game. They've recently updated it with a 120 frames per second patch. It seems like they're on top of things there. In the previous, some of the previous Star Wars games they've put out have also been cracking. I love the port of Star Wars Jedi Academy, another game that they implemented, you know, modern servers for, so you could play the online component. And it just seems with this one, they've completely dropped the ball, and they seem to be a bit of a chaotic studio, I think, because they can put out something great and support it, and they can absolutely fumble the bag with something else. Obviously, Battlefront, they fumbled it, but they were also in charge of the much bigger scale Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic remake, which, according to Jason Schreier over on Bloomberg, just became like a total mess internally, and has, by all accounts, being given to a brand new studio,
I was gonna say
Interactive Entertainment to more or less take the lead on it, because there was so much mismanagement in Aspyr, and it's like, what is, like, it's hard to, obviously, we've seen the news stories over the past few weeks. It's hard to keep a video game studio running in the modern climate.
Yeah.
And I'm sure as a studio of Aspyr's caliber, who is known for ports, who is known for remasters, will come under a lot of scrutiny, might find it difficult to, get those big contracts in or whatever. But still, like what's going on that these games can be so lopsided in their quality?
And it's like they either pull it off and you get the Tomb Raider Remastered Collection, which is a phenomenal version of those original games. It even added a photo mode and poses and filter. Like, it's awesome. Really, really well done. Runs beautifully, etc. I wonder on the Star Wars side if it's more from the top down, like if there's more things they have to get signed off from the top down. I remember when me and Ewan were previewing Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, and we were talking to the people from Respawn down in London years ago before the pandemic, saying about how hard it was to get something over the finish line with Disney as the person you have to bounce everything off, and how, you know, one little change means a few days worth of waiting for a reply, and you're just sitting there waiting to get something done. And I just wonder how much that's still the case. Like, you read about so many on fire elements of Disney every other day, and trying to wrangle all that together into some sort of focused creative vision, and then their main output is still movies, etc. Their gaming division, there was all the stuff that happened with LucasArts and trying to regain the IP, and then like, all of this stuff comes from that, trying to get back on top of all the Star Wars stuff. I just wonder if it was one of those things where they couldn't get the release date pushed back enough, or they couldn't get they had issues with the code or whatever it is. You're waiting on an email, you're waiting on responses. Like, sometimes it sounds like that's an oversimplification, but it can literally be something like that. And I'm just curious, this seems so ludicrously, hilariously on fire that and we know Aspyr are better than this. Like, there are obviously instances, like you said, there's the Knights of the Old Republic remake, the obviously beloved game from the 2000s that was going to be completely overhauled. That behind the scenes reports from Jason Schreier, from Jeff Grubb, said that they never actually got a focused demo of whatever that was going to be approved, and that they were pitching for that, even as much as months after the announcement, the teaser trailer, and then it fell apart, and it's not in development anymore. But then the most recent thing is that there's something still there. Like, again, that could be an email saying we'd still like to do this. It could be anything. And then you also have, just to throw it in, you have their work, Aspyr's work on KOTOR 2 and restoring the fan mod stuff.
That's the other one I was thinking of. Right. I was like, there was like, one did they fumble? It's that,
yeah. And it's like that whole thing where they announced they were going to be doing all the cut content patch, which is legendary in KOTOR, the KOTOR fandom, of like finishing the game essentially after Obsidian weren't able to. Saying they would do that for the remaster, not being able to, and then having to issue refunds and address that where they couldn't actually live up to that stuff. Just, it must suck trying to bring this stuff together. Like, I have the utmost sympathies for anyone working on the coding side, the dev side, anything other than the coverage side, because it just must be a living hell trying to get anything over the finish line in 2024.
Yeah, I would be really interested to see what specifically is going wrong with these games, because like you said, we do have a couple reports about KOTOR specifically. Yeah, you mentioned, you know, they apparently spent so much time working on a vertical slice to impress their publisher and Sony that, you know, they just didn't have the time to actually work on the game, and it wasn't going as smoothly as planned. But with these remasters and these ports, like, what has happened with Battlefront? Was it a Disney Lucasfilm like top-down issue where they didn't have the support they needed, or they didn't have the release date to actually release what they wanted to release? Or is there some mismanagement going on within Aspyr themselves and juggling all of these different projects, you know, like dropping Tomb Raider and then going straight into this? I don't know. I don't even think, you know, it was such a big thing when this was announced, and it felt like an easy win.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, yes, we love Battlefront. It's coming back, and it's coming back in a good way. Awesome. I'll get my pre-orders in right now. But like, LucasArts have just had the Dark Forces remake like last month. It's not like they needed two of these at once necessarily. Could this not have been pushed back a little bit? The cynic in me says they wanted to get this out alongside a few of the other things because it's coming up to the end of the financial year. Maybe they've pushed it to the limit of when they could release it. They wouldn't have wanted to do it in April or May because then it counts to next year's revenue stream. I don't know. That's like the cynical businessman. No, I'm not a businessman, but you know what I mean? That kind of cynic businessman brain in me that I think that way.
No, man, I think if I was going to hazard a guess as to what's happened, if you think about the remasters, the re-releases of old games, Dark Forces felt very much like a reminder of what first-person shooter Star Wars was like, with a view to Respawn's game coming up going forward, which they're now no longer doing. Yeah. Like anything, and this always happens in the industry, if you look at remasters and think why now, it's because they want to build hype towards whatever the next main installment is. Like we got the Mass Effect Legendary Edition because we have the next Mass Effect coming. Like I said, Dark Forces would go straight into a first-person shooter Star Wars. Battlefront remasters are likely a reminder of Battlefront in general, the IP in general, for the next main installment of Battlefront. Assumedly not with EA anymore, but I wonder if that's what this was. And then maybe you have that whole reshuffle, all the layoffs, you've got all the stuff happening over at Disney, the various studios, and it's like, just get this over the finish line. We'll patch it later. Just get it out there. We're not doing the next thing anymore. It doesn't matter. Just get it over there.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, man. I mean, you look at the Star Wars license as a whole, like moving away from just the Aspyr-produced products at this moment in time. Look at that in the gaming space, and it has been like, there's been some highs, but there's been a lot of lows over the past few years. You know, they cancelled Battlefront 3. There was the controversy with Battlefront 2, the EA version. Then we had, you know, Jedi Survivor last year, which I loved, but it was undeniably plagued by issues at launch, not too dissimilar to Battlefront that we have now. You know, that was another Star Wars game coming in hot, where people said, why wasn't this delayed a little bit? Why couldn't you have polished this up before you released it? Because there's something great there, but you're just kind of fumbling it. Same with KOTOR 2, same with the KOTOR big remake. And I look at something like Star Wars Outlaws, which is apparently also coming this year, and I think, please don't suffer the same fate. Please be actually good and be actually polished and be one of the good ones and not one of the bad ones.
At least Outlaws is like its own thing. Like it's not like the, you know, it's not like Dark Forces and then the DNA that would go through to a first-person shooter Mandalorian game or the Battlefront IP. Outlaws isn't a previous thing. So I guess it's maybe safe kind of thing.
I thought that about Jedi Survivor, man. I thought they won't repeat the mistakes of Fallen Order again, and then they did. And then it was as broken, if not more broken. Mm-hmm. Outlaws is one that I am. It's rare that I'm like cynical about games before they come out. You know me, I'm always hyped. I was hyped about the definitive edition of GTA until I was proven otherwise. I was hyped about Cyberpunk until I was proven otherwise. Outlaws, I have a bad feeling about, you know. Very good. But I just think of that coming from Ubisoft, and I look at these other Star Wars games, and I think, ooh,
I know.
I don't know. I want to be proven wrong. I want to love it. Of course I do. But I don't know where Star Wars is at the minute, man. It's up and down.
They have no idea. I think going forward, obviously, Aspyr have said they're going to put more servers online. They're going to do what they can. It's very much another case of an audience being beta testers, an audience being trialed, paying for something that isn't finished. But at least it's a budget release. It's not full price, as in £70, $70. But it's unacceptable. How many more times?
I said to you, you know, before we started recording, I think my angle on this is like, we should not be in a world, we should not be living in 2024 looking at Star Wars Battlefront, the collection, on a store page for, what is it, £24, £29? I can't remember what it is.
It's a cheaper game, yeah.
Discount, but like at a discount, in having to look up technical guides as to whether it's worth it.
Yes.
It should be an easy yes or no. Like, do I want to play this game? Do I have nostalgia for this game? Yes. Do I not fancy Star Wars Battlefront? No. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have to be this complicated for a game that old is my thing.
I spent most of the weekend going, I'd love to just hop on this. Oh, okay, the servers are on fire. Okay, not necessarily on these platforms, but it's the same shared servers. Right, the PC version's on fire. Should I get it on Switch? That one's reviewing well. Oh, but the conditions of the review were different to the public launch now. Like, I hate it. It's just horrible. Next thing down is the PlayStation 5 Pro, and we're going to do a bigger video on this, so we'll just touch on it on the podcast. But this comes from a known leaker I've put down, YouTuber Moore's Law is Dead, who is responsible for various tech leaks over time, revealing the specs for the PlayStation 5 Pro, and apparently this is coming later in 2024, which had been previously rumored anyway, and the general justification being that Sony would want a PlayStation 5 Pro out there, market saturation, etc., before GTA 6. However, there is a counterpoint to this, that they might delay it until next year when they've got more exclusives and just more things that are PlayStation-based first party to talk about. But if you want to just know like the general takeaway, and I'm terrible with like tech spec stuff, so I was just like, how much better is it? Can you give me a number? And the general takeaway is just that it is much better about optimizing rendering. It's like 30% faster or something. It has the same CPU as the existing PS5. It's more about optimizing that stuff. But overall, apparently they want to make a very competitively priced model for the console. And it's going to have a detachable hard drive as well, which is what the new PS5 Slims have.
Yeah.
So thoughts on this?
I had a dream a few days ago, Scott Tilford,
yes.
where I was having a nightmare, actually, because I had bought the PlayStation 5 Pro, and then they immediately announced the PlayStation 6, and I was gutted, and I regretted my purchase.
That's like buying a game, and then it's on PS Plus.
Yeah, it is.
Oh,
yeah.
Cheers, guys.
Almost did that with Midnight Suns the other week, by the way. But yeah, my thing with the PlayStation 5 Pro is that, as impressive as all of this sounds, and, you know, I'm similarly not an expert on any of the tech side, but I have looked into people who are way smarter than me, who have taught me exactly like what this will do, what this actually means in practical terms. Like, I should be excited for this, but I'm not.
No.
Because I don't... There aren't the games announced that I feel like I need a beefier system for. Mm. I don't feel like I've gotten anywhere near the max amount of raw horsepower out of my regular PlayStation 5. And I just don't believe in it necessarily when the interim CEO of PlayStation is already talking about winding down the PlayStation 5 and looking towards the PlayStation 6 in the future. Will I get this and then in 3 years have to upgrade again? I think it's likely.
Almost definitely.
Almost definitely, right? So my question is, for as strong as those specs may be, what am I getting it for? Am I getting it just to have it? Or am I getting it to play, you know, back in the day I got the PlayStation 4 Pro to play Red Dead Redemption 2, to play The Last of Us Part 2, to play Ghost of Tsushima, to play all of those late period PlayStation games. And of course, PlayStation's going to have a bunch of those up their sleeve. But right now, we don't know that.
No.
And in holiday 2024, if it does launch there, they don't seem to have anything for that window at all.
I don't, like, the industry's so stupidly on fire at the minute. I feel so sorry for anyone putting stuff together that I don't buy the human reality of having to recode various performance modes into games to take advantage of this hardware, or whatever, games that are actually in motion, which is a whole bigger conversation about what the hell do people even want right now. Various reports coming out of the Game Developers Conference, or shout out to Danny O'Dwyer over on NoClip doing a whole video on what it's like pitching to a publisher right now and how impossible it is to get things over the finish line. And also what ex-Xbox head Peter Moore has been talking about, how just, you know, game prices are 10 times more now than they were back in the 2000s. It's just so much harder to get games over the finish line. Let's say you finally get one of those things approved and you're trying to develop for the Xbox Series X and S and then the PlayStation 5 and the PlayStation 5 Pro. Maybe that's just the same kind of reality that we had just before the PS5 launched, where whatever was coming out would work on the PS4, the PS4 Pro, and the different versions of the Xbox. But I'm just curious. I feel like it's so hard to pin down an executable of a vision where even games like Redfall are falling apart at the seams.
Yeah.
And then we can't even get the Battlefront collection over the finish line either. That, like, it just makes me wonder about, like, can you guys actually just prove that you can get a game over the finish line again, and then go in and go, well, actually, if you get the console, it'll run faster, it'll do whatever. Yes. Can it just run at all? Can you actually just get it working at all?
That, no, it raises a good point of, like, what are you buying it for?
Yeah.
What are you buying?
What are you buying?
What are you selling? Because
your dignity, Karen.
In my head, like, if I'm buying the PlayStation 5 Pro, it's to maximize what I'm getting out of PlayStation-specific games. And in that regard, they haven't let me down in terms of optimization. You know, games like God of War Ragnarok, I think, run amazingly.
Yeah.
I know Spider-Man 2 had a lot of bugs for some people. I guess I was fortunate enough to like not encounter
those.
Not
very many.
For me, that was a beautiful game. It ran amazingly. So did Miles Morales. So did Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart, Demon's Souls, etc. So if I'm buying it on the basis of Sony's previous history optimizing their games, I would feel confident. But then the issue arises that, well, which of those games is going to benefit the most from this? And by the time, say, Naughty Dog gets their next game out, or Sony Santa Monica gets their next game out, will we already be looking ahead to the PlayStation 6 anyway? Like, I need confirmation that something is going to drop, or at least a few games are going to drop for the PlayStation 5 Pro that maximize that and don't just leave me thinking, well, I could have waited a year and just got this on PS6.
Also, I feel like when they were advertising the PlayStation 5, you had Mark Cerny, like a lead systems architect Mark Cerny, out there talking about, you know, the SSD in the PS5 is going to mean that we can make game levels that don't have to load. We're going to do all these things, all these squeeze-throughs, all this level design, all these game mechanics that were addled by previous tech and loading times and etc. And the PS5 is going to solve all of that. It hasn't at all. Like, that's still in the vast majority of games. Like, even Final Fantasy VII Rebirth has incredible load times,
yeah.
But its level design has squeeze-throughs. Tons of AAA still have squeeze-throughs. But my point is, I don't feel like I see an average rising tide of general game design that has done away with the foibles of the past. Like, I still see the limitations in the hardware because I'm still seeing something struggling to run.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing with not having unified specs to aim for when you're developing, because if you're multi-platform, that's a whole thing. But whatever, like, it's what problem does the PS5 Pro solve when the PS5 can't even get there anyway?
I know what you mean, and I do kind of agree. I agree with a lot of your points. You know, I agree that, yeah, we've not seen games that really take advantage of the PlayStation 5 that, you know,
other than load times.
That's it. You know, I mean, I love the load times in Spider-Man. I love them in Rift Apart, but I think after the first wave of PlayStation 5 exclusives, Sony, you know, by their own admission, then relied on those cross-gen games, you know, made Horizon a cross-gen game, Gran Turismo a cross-gen game, Ragnarok a cross-gen game, and we're just getting out that period now.
Mm.
But then my thought is, if we're just getting out that period now, why do I need a PlayStation 5 Pro now? Like, until you've proven what you can kind of do with that machine. Mm. And yeah, you started to with Spider-Man 2, but like, what's next? What's the first big, like, quadruple A Sony first party exclusive that takes advantage of the hardware in a way that makes me go, like, wow, okay, I want to get a PlayStation 5 Pro for this, because there isn't one announced right now, and I'm confident it will come, but will it come quick enough
to
justify an immediate adoption?
No, I mean, that was the thing. They had the same problem when they tried to announce the PlayStation 4 Pro, where it's like, okay, you can't make a game that's PS4 Pro exclusive because the majority of your user base is on PS4, but you also need to make something in the game that justifies the people who did buy the PlayStation 4 Pro. But then, as we found out over time, that can only really be a frame rate option, or maybe a higher resolution with a frame rate. Like, there's a whole breakdown of games that have a bit more to their levels or whatever, or background detail or something like that. You can look up those lists. I remember Abzu from the art director of Journey. That game renders more fish if you play it on PlayStation 4 Pro, and the game will look more gorgeous. There's little things like that, but is that really worth like £500 or whatever it is?
That's another great question, because we talked about this a few weeks ago about what do we want even from a pro system? And I remember you saying something you've actually just echoed in your previous statement, if I'm getting lawyerific, I suppose. Better call Sauling you.
Exhibit B.
Exhibit B. You mentioned what problem does it solve?
Yeah.
I personally don't see these machines in that way. Like, I buy them for those extra bells and whistles. I buy them for the 2 to 3 times the ray tracing power that the Pro apparently has, or, you know, faster, or 35% more GPU power, or whatever it is. And those kind of additions of extra fish, better resolution, to me, that's what I am there for.
Right.
I think, you know, even Sony acknowledges that the Pro system is, PlayStation 5 is already a luxury product, but the Pro version is a proper luxury product, kind of like how, you know, Apple, you know, sells its Pro Max or whatever. It's like, it's stuff you don't need. It's not really solving a core issue, because in their heads, they'd like to think that there are no core issues anyway. It's just, if you want those games to be a little bit better, which I do, to be fair, you know, I want to max out the graphic settings as much as possible without having to delve into the ecosystem of the PC world.
Yes.
But I need the games. I need you to justify it. And I know they're leaks, so it's not fair to, you know, address the marketing, but I need you to justify the games before you sell me the thing. Mm-hmm. And if you're selling me the thing in holiday 2024, when it's the 1 year you're kind of having off, is that the best time to sell it? Should you push it maybe to the end of 2025? But then are we getting way too close to the PlayStation 6?
Mm-hmm.
You might miss the launch of Grand Theft Auto or something. I think it's a tough time to sell a machine like this, especially when I was, again, looking at people on Twitter who were replying to the specs who know more than me. They were saying, like, the price point for this thing could be mad.
Right.
Way higher than people are expecting. So is it the right time to sell this machine? And is it the right time to sell this machine at this price point? Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
No, and I just think it's going to be like the PlayStation 4, where all the conversation is like, oh, we're acting as if the console market is like the PC market, as in you buy a new graphics card and way more frequently than you buy a new console. And it's like, I see the business reality of syncing those up and being able to just sell you a console every 4 years or every 3 years. but the justification is less and less, unless you just want the biggest beast in the pound every time, which like I do. But then, like I said before, I don't trust the industry right now. I don't trust the execution of those titles to do right by the money I've invested. I don't feel like they've done that to this point. So,
brother, we're going to get to this point in a second, and I kind of don't want to cannibalize it, but as someone who owns a PSVR 2, who spent willingly over £500 on that thing and thinks it's an amazing bit of kit, an amazing bit of kit in the modern era just doesn't cut it. You need more. You need a guarantee of support. You need a guarantee that the games are going to be well optimized for the thing you have, because I think the PSVR 2 is fantastic. Do I think it's worth £500 with the current portfolio it has and the seeming lack of support on Sony's side in the future? Probably not. I don't regret buying it, but I do think it's almost way overpowered for what I'm doing. It's like buying like an insane Ferrari to drive it around the back streets of Newcastle. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, it looks cool.
Just look at it.
Yeah, I like it, but am I getting the most out of this? Yeah. I'm not on a racing track, you know what I mean?
No, that's
bad
true.
Analogy. Like, I don't know anything about cars.
That definitely works, though. To that end, Sony have stopped making PlayStation VR 2s. This is a whole new story doing the rounds. The source for this is apparently a bit unreliable, but there's so many people are going with this that it's worth covering anyway, especially in regards to the wider context of PlayStation VR 2 and the fact that it hasn't necessarily caught on anywhere near as much as Sony assumedly would like it to, and the likes of Horizon Call of the Mountain didn't really seem to move the needle. Yeah. I literally only know you that has a PSVR 2, whereas I do know a lot more people who have Oculuses, but I still feel like the conversation on VR is still this weird I was going to say Dynamite conversation, but what's the opposite of that? Like the Marmite conversation?
Yeah, the Marmite conversation.
It's just that you're either totally in or you just don't care.
Yeah, the bean sandwich conversation, some might
say. Of 1908.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The PSVR thing, like I was just saying previously, is it's tough. It is really difficult. And Sony was always fighting an uphill battle. But to see this article come out, which is on Bloomberg, but not by Jason Schreier. It's by another writer who's commented on VR stuff in the past. Like, they claim that Sony made 2 million products of the PlayStation VR 2 and is now stopping that completely because it didn't sell that many. So they're just trying to shift the stock that they actually have. And I believe it, man. I really do, because you see I think the writing has been on the wall since Sony committed to those layoffs a few weeks ago, because the studios they were closing down completely were studios like London Studio, studios like Firesprite, these teams that have worked. I mean, they literally shut down the studio that shipped the Horizon game, Horizon Call of the Mountain, that you mentioned, their one big first-party PSVR 2 experience. The team that made that has now been gutted.
Didn't they do Blood and Truth as well?
Was that a different team? Was London Studio, I think. I don't think that was who did Call of the Mountain, but yes, they also shut down London Studio, who did Blood and Truth and who was working on the PlayStation VR before then. And yeah, they've helped to produce VR exclusives like Resident Evil 8 and Resident Evil 4, which are exceptional. But as someone who owns a PlayStation VR 2 and has spent all of that money on it, like, I think it's an amazing product, but the games and the support just aren't there at all on Sony's side. And when I'm there with this kit, this piece of kit that I forked out for on the promise of getting, you know, a Half-Life Alyx killer from Sony, and when that doesn't arrive, and it doesn't seem like they're even committed to focusing on VR in the future, it's like, well, I've been mugged off there. I can champion this as much as I want. I'm having a lot of fun with it. But if I knew this was only going to last 2 years with real dedicated support, less than 2 years with real dedicated support, I'd have bought it at a discount. Those games would have been still there because a lot of them are like third-party games from years ago anyway. Great ones that I haven't played, but third-party games from years ago. And I could have just got this whole experience cheaper. Like, as an early adopter, I feel mugged off.
I feel like they've done this twice in a row. Like, I feel like the PSVR 1 felt like this MacGyver thrown together, cobbled together thing where it's like, okay, we have the PlayStation motion remotes from back when we were trying to compete with the Kinect. Let's have them be the controllers. And then we'll have this really dialed back budget VR experience to test the waters. And then I never really felt like they had any like must play stuff over there, even though there were the likes of Blood and Truth. I remember the Rick and Morty game doing the rounds back when the first few seasons of the show were blowing up. Like, there were talking talking points of like, you should see this on PSVR. And I remember when No Man's Sky dropped and it was like, this is like full intergalactic VR. You can just live in this space. That's so cool. And then I just felt like it just kind of cooled overall. I felt like they didn't figure out the marketing. I don't feel like they found out a way to convince people that they should try things in VR. They tried the Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man cam, where it's just like the shot of you in the experience.
Yeah.
But like, to me, they never really got it out there. And it's maybe it's just the reality of physical video games going away so much. Like, so many people just buy digital. They're not in video game stores anymore. There's age bracket stuff where like maybe a bunch of teens would have cared kind of thing if they got the demos out there and you could try things and whatever. There's the health, there's the cleanliness side of it where no one really wants to try a headset that 20 other kids have just had. They never figured that out. And I think that was an issue. There was never buzz around VR. Like there was within the circles who were already up for it, but they never convinced the masses that it was worth it. And then, so to me, it felt like they abandoned PSVR 1 after Blood and Truth and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then to me, it's all happening again. It was like, we've got Horizon, guys, and we've got like worthwhile things to look at. Are you going to convince me they're worth it? No? Okay, cool. I'm going to be over here if you guys ever figure this out. And now you haven't.
They do need a Half-Life, Alex, because I don't know how you feel about that game, but I felt that was the one VR game that really cut through just VR circles. Mm. Like, it was talked about as a Game of the Year contender across the board for that year. It might not have made you go out and buy, I can't remember what platform it released on, Valve's VR headset. But it got you talking about the game. It got you talking about, is this the future of the medium? Like, if Valve are doing things with Half-Life and VR they couldn't do on a regular flat screen, should we pay more attention to it? And across PlayStation VR 1 and across PlayStation VR 2, Sony just hasn't had that killer app from a first-party perspective. Don't get me wrong. They have some of the best games I have ever played on the PlayStation VR 2. No joke. When I'm playing stuff like Pistol Whip, when I'm playing stuff like Pavlov, when I'm playing stuff like Saints and Sinners 2, when I'm improvising my way around this open-world, zombie-infested apocalypse, I am, like, I feel like a kid again. Yeah. I feel like I'm having brand new, unique gaming experiences that I wouldn't otherwise get. But the issue there is you can get every single game I just mentioned on other VR platforms, much cheaper in some cases, VR platforms. And a lot of those games, they're old anyway. Like Pavlov, I think, first released in 2017. And yeah, it got a big update for the PlayStation VR 2 with the switch to Unreal Engine 5. But that game is something people have experienced for years at this point. And while that can support a device like the PlayStation VR 2, it can't allow it to pierce the mainstream and convince people to buy that specifically. Because you're not just buying the headset, you need to buy a PlayStation 5 alongside it.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
You need to drop $400 on a PlayStation 5 and then drop $500 on a PSVR 2. And then suddenly that price is like outrageous, especially when you're only buying it to play games that you can get on an Oculus Quest 2 that you can just chuck on your head and then have a good time with.
Yeah, the PSVR 2 still had all the cable issues. Like, it wasn't this, like, sleek, just grab it whenever you want, put it on. Like, the way that VR works in movies or in sci-fi, where you just put it on and it renders and it works. Like, I feel like that was the VR dream that PSVR couldn't get there with. But yeah, the game side of it though as well, like, yeah, you've forked out the money, right, let's do this. I've forked out almost £1,000 on this thing, let's sit down and do it. And then you're playing what should be the best experience possible, Horizon Call of the Mountain. It's the first party endorsed thing. And I remember when we were talking about Horizon, you just saying like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine. It's another first person showcase where it's like, look, like, I mean, Horizon has climbing segments, there's obviously the bow and arrow stuff, it's nice and responsive, but it didn't feel like anything that you couldn't do in a first person shooter or that was already being done in first person in the first person space.
Yeah.
To me, I always thought that VR needed experiences that when you see them as someone who didn't care about VR, you would be like, I need to play that. Because if there's anything in the AAA space or in the regular gaming space that stands out, it's stale, overused mechanics. And I remember the first time on the original PSVR when I was playing the Until Dawn spin-off, Rising Blood or whatever it's called.
Rush of Blood.
There was one bit where there was two waves of like zombies coming at me from opposite sides and I was looking both ways, shooting them both like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I fundamentally couldn't do that to pan around properly and actually aim properly and remember where my hand was and then measure all that space in real time. That was the only thing that like got me where I was like, that's actually something that you can't do before and I need VR for that. And I needed infinitely more experiences like that. And I know they're out there based on what you've described, but I don't feel like they've communicated them, showcased them, hung the tech on them. They're there if you buy in, but you've got to buy in to find them.
That's it, right? And I think it's between a rock and a hard place, because for me, VR's biggest strength is refreshing what would otherwise be a set of pretty boilerplate mechanics. Mm. Like, if I just described The Walking Dead Saints and Sinners to you, it would sound like the most boring, overdone game you've ever played. Yeah. Like a survival zombie game where you go out, you kill zombies, you bring your gear back. But when you get the tactility of virtual reality, like, it just elevates those kind of seemingly basic sets of mechanics, because suddenly it's more in the moment, it's more immersive.
Like, you're holding the guy and hitting
him.
It's
literally, it's more physically exerting to have to manage all these things, look over your shoulder to see zombies, like, rushing you and, like, trying to climb away from them and stuff like that, trying to hide. Like, it just elevates them so much, but unless you've actually experienced it, you can't really sell someone on that, because it's so vague. And you even now, when I describe it to you, you're probably thinking of a slightly different game than it even is in the moment. And that's, like, almost impossible. And it's certainly impossible at a nearly £1,000 price point. And that is a shame, because, like I said, I love all of those games and I want VR to succeed. I genuinely think it could be the future of the medium, but I can totally see why it's not been widely adopted. And I can totally see Sony canning proper support for it going forward.
You would have to relentlessly prove that it is worth it. Go on all that future of the medium stuff. Otherwise, to me, it default felt like when 3D was the future of film. And I just went, like, I doubt it, but I'll watch your 3D movie. Okay, it looks a bit naff, it's a bit blurry, whatever. I don't buy you anymore. But if they kept going and going and going, like, maybe eventually they would have had some sort of movie experience that would have been fundamentally enhanced by being in 3D. The VR thing, a huge elephant in the room with VR is the physical side of it. Like, I don't want to game standing up, running around my living room. I don't want to do that. I don't like the shutting off the world kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know people do, because it's full 100% immersion. And I do a version of that with headphones on and I'm playing games and stuff. But I do think that the literal reality of just, that's not how I want to game, is maybe far more of the majority than Sony ever thought it was.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I would almost compare it to people who own a racing wheel. And that is another kind of similar commitment, I would say, where racing wheels are awesome. They undoubtedly make racing games better, but it's an investment. A lot of them are quite expensive, and you need the space to have a racing wheel with a chair in the setup for that, right? And it is, I think, VR is, I would say, a little bit more accessible. You know, a lot of the headsets are wireless right now, and, you know, we were talking about the wire issues with VR too. To me, that's not a problem. It's one wire that kind of plugs straight into the PlayStation, and then you're suddenly good to go. I would say that, again, it's something I have to sell you on, right? Because it's not necessarily being marketed correctly, but I would say there are so many experiences on the platform that don't require much from you physically at all. Like, Gran Turismo, if you want to play that in VR, it's literally you sit on the couch, you put the VR headset on.
Oh, Wipeout VR rules.
And you play with the controller. Like, even if you're bringing in the actual hand controllers, the I can't remember what they're called, like DualSense VR, whatever it is. Like, you can play a lot of games sat down. Like, I play Saints and Sinners sat down a lot of the time. I played Resident Evil 8 sat down. I think sometimes those games can benefit from standing up, but not everything is this kind of full body, full motion, physically exerting thing. But again, it's a hard
that's on them to sell.
The stereotype of VR is like is the guy in like a massive living room, and he's like, you know, fighting dragons over here, and he's running around. It's physically exerting, and that there are experiences that mimic that and accurately reflect that, but it's not necessarily everything, and it is much more convenient, I think, than it probably looks from the
outside. Well, that's the thing, because I feel like VR marketing 101 is mark out your safe zone, look at this guy in his living room or in a big open space, which is a whole thing for a lot of people who might not even have the space. Yeah. I don't in my house. Like, I can move stuff around, but I'm not going to change my room every time I want to do something. I think that's a whole thing. That reality of, like, it's not as easy as just picking up a DualSense and it connects and it works. I have to go and plug it in, I have to disconnect it again. It's tiny things, but I think they get in the way of the usability of it. And then, like you said, like, there are experiences that are cool to just sit down and take in, but it doesn't feel like they're front and center. Like, if you had marketing that mimicked the way the Switch was introduced, where it was like, okay, here it is as a home console, the guys picked it up and now it's handheld and whatever. I remember even then Nintendo were like, and also you can use the stand to stand it there and use it that way. Like, they were like, three ways to play was the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's like VR marketing should be like, it enhances everything. Like, you know, here it is on a big space, you're also sitting down, like, you're doing whatever. They never got that across. Like, this VR as a medium hasn't got that across.
No, not at all. And it's a shame because the games themselves do such a good job of catering to a bunch of different play styles. Mm. Like every game now more or less will have a standing or sitting mode unless it's something that specifically requires standing. I know Pavlov is standing only, for instance, but like they have all of these options to like help you and to make the thing more accessible.
Mm-hmm. Like eye tracking as well?
Yeah, the eye tracking and completely tweak the way your movement works in so many games to kind of reduce motion sickness or to make you more comfortable. Like,
it's a whole other thing as well, motion sickness.
So much work has been put into the comfortability side of it that just kind of hasn't been reflected in the marketing. And yeah, it might be impossible to reflect that because you need that hands-on experience. But I almost think, in a way, it was a shame that I love the PSVR 1, but it's almost a shame that to many people, that is what VR gaming is. I remember when we did a video on the channel where we played Resident Evil 4 VR.
Yes.
And I remember you were impressed by the manual reloading, like actually knocking in the clip and pulling the slide back. And I remember thinking in the moment, like, it's such a shame that to you that's novel, because that was stuff that was happening like a decade ago.
But just that, not on the PSVR.
But that obviously hasn't been conveyed. Like, it was in the PSVR, but it was like the later games, you know what I mean?
Right.
That kind of required a bit more functionality. And it's like, oh, it's a shame because that to you is so new, but that to me now is like almost an old hat to be expected mechanic. And it's like, I think a lot of people's like preconceptions of what VR is based on that kind of PlayStation VR 1's rudimentary approach to it. Because like you said, great piece of kit for the price at the time, I think, but it was hobbled together. It didn't have the controllers that were built for that purpose. And now you actually have a machine that does all of that well, but people are like, well, it had all these issues before and I kind of don't really want to jump in that price. And I think that's valid.
They should have launched, if this was the original PSVR and it didn't launch alongside a new console, like you can argue the pandemic's an issue as well, it probably is, but you're asking people to fork out for a new system. They're rare anyway, so they're hard to get a hold of. And then you need to double up and get the VR. If this was a mid-generation piece of kit, if this was instead of a PlayStation 4 Pro a few years ago or whatever, instead of, you know, just a step up for the base system, I think it would do a hell of a lot better.
Yeah.
And if the tech itself was in a better place like it is now, then you've got a whole market who are just like, what's the next thing? Oh, it's this? Cool.
Yeah.
And then also you need to pair that with like having a steady rollout of releases and people are ready for the next thing. Like I said, my whole thing with the industry is that we're not even hitting the base level of stuff anymore.
No. I mean, we talked about when we mentioned the PlayStation 5 Pro, that's like, well, I said it's like a look. I don't want to lump you in with my opinion,
Bring
Scott
it
Telford.
On.
I said it's like that's a pure luxury product, right? And that's what PSVR 2 feels like in the current economic climate with console sales kind of stagnating a little bit. Like, it's an impossible sell almost to get people to fork out that much money for a piece of, let's face it, experimental technology. That's how it's perceived in the mainstream, and that's a shame as someone who owns one, because these games rule and I just want more support for it, please. I'm literally going to go home tonight and I'm going to spark out Ivan Drago while I'm playing the Apollo Creed game, and he's going to take a few body shots and I'm going to like knock him to the ground and I'm going to feel exhilarated, but I'm going to take the headset off and I'm going to look around and no one's going to be there to share in that joy, because no one else, rightly so, wants to jump into this experience with me.
We'll see how it shakes out. For now, all we know is that they've stopped making stuff, but it might come back around. For now, though, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Telford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Telford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Take care. We'll catch you throughout the week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.